Good afternoon. My name is Paul Holdengraber, and I am the Director of Public Programs here at the New York Public Library, known as Live from the New York Public Library. You've heard me say this 100 times, so why not 101 times? My goal at the library is simply to make the lions roar. I will not be giving you any biographies because they're all in your pen booklets. So if you want to know who this distinguished group of people is, just look in the booklet and you'll get a description of them. I also would like to encourage you to sign up on our email list so that you might find out the events we have coming up. For instance, we will have Philip Gurevich and Errol Morris week after next, and Salman Rushdie at the very end of the year. We will end the year right after Salman Rushdie with a celebration of Ian Fleming, so an event on James Bond. I think it's rather appropriate. I would like to thank Caro Llewellyn, the director of the Penn World Voice Festival, and of course her whole team as well on the library side, Kim Irwin and Meg Stemler. This is the fourth time that we participate in the Penn World Voices Festival, and I think the Penn World Voices Festival has happened for 4 years. After this event, which will last about as long as a psychoanalytical session, about an hour, you will have occasion to ask some questions. Let me insist on the notion of questions, if you know what I mean. In other words, comments that last 29 minutes, try to avoid them, but go up to the panelists afterwards to ask a very long-winded question. There will be a signing afterwards. Our wonderful independent bookstore, 192 Books, is here today. So do go up to that table to have your book signed. And now, without further ado, I'd like to introduce Paul Van Zyl, who will introduce a panel on Truth and Reconciliation, A National Reckoning. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Paul, and thank you very much to the New York Public Library and to Penn for assembling such a distinguished and interesting group of people. And I hope to moderate an interesting conversation. I must start by saying that I'm not wild about the idea of moderating a conversation about a legacy of mass atrocity, because I think mass atrocity and conversation about mass atrocity should not be moderate, and I really shouldn't be invigorating a conversation about mass atrocity, and given at least some of the personalities that I have clustered around me, I'm fairly confident we'll have a rather vigorous conversation. Let me start by a few remarks. The first is that all of these authors have written the books that we will focus on today about countries which themselves have experienced terrible and systematic human rights abuse. And in a large number of those countries, that terrible and systematic abuse continues. And so the notion of dealing with a legacy of abuse, dealing with a past of abuse, is itself rather complex because there is a past and a present. And I think that that makes the conversation both rich but complex, because the past and the present are in a dialogue with each other relating to human rights abuse. The second thing I'd like to say is that human beings have to, by definition, forget. If we remembered everything, we would go insane. And therefore, we spend a great deal of our waking hours forgetting. And we spend much more of our time forgetting than remembering. And in fact, memory is a highly selective exercise. And only a part of memory is shaped by ourselves. There are a whole range of forces and actors around us, memory merchants, as it were, who shape the way we both individually and collectively as nations understand our past. And in some ways, the people we have assembled here today are memory merchants. They're people who tell stories about countries, and they help shape our collective memory about the past. And I would argue that that matters a great deal, that part of Germany's transformation from a country which gave birth to the Holocaust to a country which is by no means perfect, but which by global standards today is certainly deeply democratic and rather respecting of human rights, is because of memory merchants. It's about people who have forced that country and that nation to engage with its past, to engage with very difficult questions of complicity, of culpability, of direct perpetration, of victim identity and of victimhood. And so, again, I hope this is something that we will galvanize today. So let me start, and maybe start with Francisco, who has really written a remarkable book about really an iconic murder in Guatemala, the murder of Bishop Girardi. Can you tell us why you think it's important for nations to grapple with a past of abuse, and whether you think there is, in fact, a case to be made for forgetting?
I think that the Bishop Girardi was murdered precisely because he it was a truth commission murder. It was a murder to prevent a truth commission from happening, basically. I mean, there's two questions there, right? And what's at stake? I think that that the Guatemalan army, at the end of this 36-year civil war, in which they had basically trounced the guerrillas, found themselves in a position where they had to negotiate with the guerrillas, negotiate a peace. It was sponsored by the United Nations. And the reason they went in on this was because after 19 years of Guatemala having been listed, you know, by the UN among the world's worst human rights violators and so forth, they needed, for economic reasons and so forth, to end their pariah state status and rejoin the world community. But they could dictate the terms, right? So they said that, sure, you know, this is a 36-year war in which people knew as many as 200,000 people had been murdered. Probably half of those 200,000 people had been murdered in a two-year period during a scorched earth campaign in the countryside. And they dictated, they said, okay, we will have, the first thing they imposed was a blanket amnesty. Nobody had ever been put on trial for any of those 200,000 deaths. You had a concrete wall of pure impunity that basically protected the power of the military in Guatemala. And they said, we're going to have a blanket amnesty. Nobody can look into the crimes of the past, nobody can be prosecuted for the crimes of the past. And we're also going to allow a UN-sponsored truth commission of sorts who can look into the past, but aren't going to be allowed to assign individual blame. You know, they can just speak generally, they thought, about what has happened. And Bishop Girardi felt strongly, as the head of the Church Human Rights Office, that was just no way to go into. In other words, they were saying, to make this transition into democracy, we are commanding that the past be forgotten. And we're going to build, it's this theory that we can build democratic institutions based on forgetting. Of course, he knew that meant we're going to build so-called democratic institutions where all the power is still going to be in the hands of the same guys who committed all the atrocities. And he also knew that it was a country that was in a state of permanent trauma and shock and horror, right? Because as much as you can say, isn't forgetting a wonderful, yes, let's forget, the people who've lost family, the people who've lost relatives, the people who've seen their villages wiped out, they never forget. Nobody can ever tell you, forget your murdered relative, forget your disappeared relative. So Bishop Girardi said the church was going to do its own truth commission report. It was a remarkable thing. He sent, he went through the church parish system, humble people. You know, he was not like the sort of Yale-educated lawyers who were going to come down for the UN commission. He knew these people in these villages would never talk to. They'd see them as outsiders. And these people went out with their tape recorders into the mountains and just started to collect testimonies. And on April 24th, 1998, he presided over the presentation of this 1,000-page, 4-volume report that did name names, that documented 400 of the 600 massacres, that named by name 50,000 of the 200,000 dead, and so forth, and concluded 80% of the deaths by the army, 5% by the guerrillas. He documented 30-something guerrilla massacres, 400-plus army massacres. Well, this was, you can imagine, this was not what the army had expected. It was not anything they'd ever expected to hear. You know, it's not why they negotiated a peace. And 2 days after the release of that report, he was murdered.
And on balance, do you think that the process of looking back has served Guatemala well, has been difficult and divisive, or has been essential and indispensable to its reconstruction as a, or construction as a democratic state?
Essential and indispensable, without a doubt. I think people sometimes get confused. They think truth commission and memory automatically means prosecutions, and they're two separate things. You know, because of what Bishop Hardy had done, he'd broken this taboo. The UN Truth Commission, in fact, was incredibly successful. And they managed to do an even more exhaustive report and ended up, under UN auspices, accusing the Guatemalan army of genocide, which technically, on paper, because there can be no amnesty for crimes against humanity, undid the amnesty. But for the people, and this thing, it's been an unbelievable, the idea that people have finally been able to speak out, you know, all over the country. There are, you know, they're in every corner of the Guatemalan mountains now, they're unearthing massacre sites and so forth. And just to understand what that means to people who've lost family, you know, these are basically Mayan Indians who believe that if the soul of your family member isn't buried, you know, in the village, they will wander in horror. And you hear these extraordinary stories from people, like the people who are, for the forensic teams will be out digging, and the survivors will say, oh no, I forget, you know, they were buried maybe over there, and they go back and they have a dream, and they hear their ancestors like speaking to them in their dream saying, no, no, I'm buried over there, I'm buried over by that tree. And they go back the next day and tell the anthropologist that, and they go and dig there and they find them. And it's just incredibly, you know, I wouldn't use the word healing, but there's something so violent about having to keep silent about that kind of trauma. It's like the violence continuing over and over and over again. Every day you can't speak about it or having it acknowledged. And that's what's been so important.
Yeah. Rian Milan, your book, My Traitor's Heart, in some ways defies pigeonholing and is one of those incredibly dense and complex pieces of work that messes with people's understanding of culpability. What do you think about the way South Africa has sought to deal with its sordid past?
Can I preface what I'm about to say by confessing absolute ignorance about truth commissions in countries other than my own? So I'm speaking entirely now from a South African perspective. I mean, I think the history of South Africa would be generally familiar to both to all of you. It was my position in the early 90s that the wounds of history were too deep, and the chasms of class and culture that separated people were way too deep to be bridged by negotiations and peace talks. So I was quite convinced that the South African drama would end in race war. On the 27th of April 1994, I was plunged in, as usual, into disgrace, and my dire prophecies turned out to be incorrect. What had happened at that point is, I think, is like maybe a good ending to any war, is that you have to contrive a situation where the combatants can leave the battlefield with a measure of honor and dignity. And so for me, this is a moment of a blinding revelation. Nelson Mandela standing on the day of his inauguration as cannons thundered and jets flew past, raising the hands of the arm of his enemy de Klerk and saying in Afrikaans, "Wat verby is, is verby," what's done is done. It was a magical moment in South Africa, and given the fact that I'm white and my bias, is that the next 18 months were sort of a very sweet honeymoon, especially when we won the Rugby World Cup. And Madiba turned up to wear a Springbok jersey. There's a magical interlude in South Africa. And then our Truth Commission came along, and I I struggle to, I mean, the poet Ted Hughes said that truth kills. And truth is a very difficult and dangerous thing. If you use the analogy of somebody had been cheating on a spouse, maybe truth is the very last thing that you want to put on the table. The Truth Commission in South Africa, I think it's succeeded largely in opening old wounds, reminding Africans of the extent of their humiliation and suffering under apartheid, and because the process was sort of biased and distorted, and making whites like me feel very resentful. And so at the end of the day, South Africa is an unusual story in that I don't think the truth particularly was obscured in South Africa, perhaps to the extent that happened in Guatemala. I mean, you know, they were making movies in Hollywood about people being tortured in South Africa in the 1980s. The New York Times, you know, this industry of publishing, exposing the sins of apartheid. So I don't think the South African Truth Commission was deficient in some ways on truth. It was really quite biased. And as for reconciliation, I never believed at the outset that the sort of exercise in truth telling was going to enable people to love each other again. And I don't think it did.
Is there a case to be made for reconciliation? And do you think there's a way in which you can seek to proactively generate it?
I would have said that the idea of a truth commission is perhaps a very good one, but it has to be rigorously impartial. It has to be staffed and run by people who have the integrity of a priesthood and are seen by all conflicts of the party as being impartial. And then they should pursue the truth with absolute rigor. Yes, I mean, in South Africa's, at the risk of boring you, then, I think that all the truth commissions are, throughout the world, have been consequence of, they've usually grown out of Cold War conflicts where you had a repressive right-wing regime battling against sort of Marxist-Leninist insurgents. And these conflicts all petered out towards after perestroika and certainly after the collapse of the Berlin Wall. Our Truth Commission in South Africa was very keen to recast what had happened in South Africa over the last 50 years, the last 300, if you will, into a sort of fairly sentimental, soft-focused human rights context. And in the process, major distortions, or perhaps I should say simplifications, crept in. This city was a great site of struggle in the war against apartheid. And for many years, you had like prominent liberals like Thomas Karras or Bernard, liberals writing the New York Times saying that anyone who said that the ANC, the liberation movement in our case, was influenced by or dominated by communists was like a savage redneck McCarthyite redbaiter. That was the position taken by the fascists in Pretoria, and they were, of course, widely laughed at. They said, you know, at least half of the ANC's leadership was secretly in the Communist Party. Now it turns out that they were wrong, too. And of the 30 people who sat on the ANC's national executive during the struggle years, all but one was secretly a member of the Communist Party of South Africa, which is a... So the Truth Commission wanted to portray that, you know, for me that meant in South Africa it wasn't just a struggle between good and evil, democracy and fascism, because it seemed to me that we had this right-wing dictatorship, semi-racial right-wing dictatorship that was going to be replaced by a Marxist-Leninist police state. It undermined my enthusiasm for the struggle. The same was true of the racial context. I'll shut up now. You know, it's once again a Manichaean portrayal of like white vice on one side and black good on the other. Or a struggle between a heavily racist white regime and the forces of non-racialism on the other. It's another fundamental distortion. The ANC, Nelson Mandela's party, didn't admit white people until 1985, Conference of Kabwe. That was sort of 3 or 4 years ahead of the National Party. But anyway, at the end of the day, I sort of felt I was very personally alienated by the Truth Commission in South Africa. I felt that it was essentially a good idea that could have been much better executed and might have left less of a legacy of sort of bitterness and discontent.
So then, on that basis, let's move slightly further north and talk about Rhodesia, Zimbabwe. Both of your books have dealt in some way with this question. And give me a sense of some of the complexity and difficulty you see in in grappling with what are probably going to be twin evils in Zimbabwe's process of grappling with the past, both a repressive white regime and now a highly repressive Mugabe regime.
I once gave a talk in Aspen, Colorado, and I made about 30 people walk out of the room because I got a question like that, and it was right after the Attorney General scandal here. And somebody asked me a question about Mugabe's government, and you know, she was asking this. It's a comfortable question to give because we can look at Mugabe, and the guy's obviously an insane, you know, megalomaniac. So I said, yes, yeah, I'll get the list out of his wrongdoings. And I said, you know, he started an illegal war, which has bankrupt the country, and he fired everyone who doesn't agree with him, and he hires his incompetent cronies, and there's been terrible inflation, and I said, wait, that's George Bush's list. What have I done with Mugabe? With which there was this horrified gasp, and these people sort of staggered out, and I think...
This is New York.
Okay. Are we okay? No one's staggered out. And I grappled personally for a long time, just sort of trying to understand who Ian Smith was, and hearing stories from my mother that he was very compassionate, and his wife Janet was good to orphans. I think she sort of patted them on the head or something. And I, you know, I remember after, it took us a long, long time after the shock of the war. I'm reading Rian's book right now, and I mean, I'm in trauma. I'm barely coherent. I was up till 5 o'clock this morning reading it. I read it as a young woman, and now I'm sort of older, and it's actually affecting me far worse now than it did. When I was young, it was a relief. I thought, oh, good, man, we've got the truth on the table. Lovely. Now, presumably, we can all move on. What I'm seeing now is the book has this god-awful weight of truth to it, that you can't give birth. Any peace that was birthed out of violence will eventually spawn violence. And I remember sort of coming to grips with this government that had raised me and the propaganda and what we had believed and what, and trying to dig up what that meant about my parents' situation during the war. My mother was so adamantly pro-white government, and what did that mean about had happened to me? And I said to my mom once, how could you have voted for Ian Smith? And she said, well, it wasn't someone more right-wing. So, and actually the other shocking thing is my mother phoned me a few weeks, you know, when McCain was nominated as the head of the Republican Party, and my mother said, now that's really scary. He's very right-wing. And I thought, you know, that says something right there. My mother finds McCain scary. And she said, I said, well, you know, the Republican Party don't think he's right-wing enough. And she said, what does he have to do, bring back slavery? So there was this, I think what, you know, happened after the end of the war, and I think one of the reasons Mugabe is able to go back and sort of look at the abuses of the whites and use it to his benefit is that there was no truth spoken. I'm not sure there ever could be any truth spoken. I think our tongues were absolutely knotted with grief at the end of the war. There were people like my mother who felt like she had lost. And she will tell you it broke her heart. What happened broke her heart. And there was, it's built into the psyche not to talk about it. And so there was just this deadly silence. And I don't think you can go back and say, I wish we all had had a big psychotherapy session and sorted it all out either. But I do think not talking about it enabled Mugabe to sort of jump on the abuse of it. And it was just like pushing buttons. He could say the word Chimurenga and that instantly meant something to people. And there was no sense of what really happened, who was complicit. And there were no reparations. And I think that's been, who really cares about truth and reconciliation when there's no reparations? And the only truth and reconciliation that I saw ever really happening was in the government schools, where we were on a level playing field. We all got exactly the same food. We slept in the same bed. We had the same uniforms. We played the same sports. We went to the same classes. So there was a sense that, well, we're all on a level playing field. And the children very quickly came to a sense of reconciliation. But outside of the schools where that wasn't happening, it's very hard to reconcile yourself when, okay, wait, I'm supposed to understand and forgive you, but you've still got the farm and the Mercedes Benz, and I'm still stuck in some scrubby little piece of desert with a goat. You know, I'm not feeling that forgiving.
One of the things you mentioned is the idea of complicity and how we understand complicity. And I'm struck at a crucial moment in the South African experience. I was a witness against our former president, P.W. Botha, who was standing trial for a technicality for having defied a subpoena on the truth by the Truth Commission. And we brought into the courtroom the then only imprisoned member of a hit squad, a man by the name of Eugene de Kock, to testify about his relationship to both the political leadership in South Africa and white South Africa in general, both of whom had sought to run away from the authorization of terrible atrocity. And in his very gritty metaphor, Eugene de Kock stood in the witness stand, looked down at P.W. Botha, who was in the dock, and said to him, "You know, the problem with people like P.W. Botha is he wanted to eat lamb every night, but he never wanted to see the blood and guts. And we delivered the blood and guts." So at that moment, I had this sort of shiver. And as I read, your story of Kay, who in a way in the Rhodesian Light Infantry was in the business of delivering the blood and guts, it made me think about who takes responsibility for Kay, because it's Kay can take responsibility for himself or not, and that's interesting, but who ought to be taking responsibility for him, and how do they do it?
You know, I think as Rhodesians we weren't a very good example of how to run a war, but we were a great warning. And I mean, I keep saying this now, and I think we can look at Rhodesia, and we were this tiny little microcosm of things where we built up this army, we built up this idea of freedom, our propaganda. You were either for us or against us. I mean, George W. Bush and my mother are really, I've never seen them in the same place at the same time. I'm beginning to think they're the same person. But that same sort of rhetoric about, you know, you're either for it, the simplicity of it, I'm kind of jealous of it. You know, I see our president speak and I think, God, that looks so simple. But where are you when it gets more complicated? Why aren't we seeing the boys and these coffins coming home, men and women? Why is there all this? The flavor of secrecy is so similar. It's on such a larger scale in the United States that we can dilute it. In Rhodesia and Zimbabwe, it was condensed to one toxic little drop, and so everyone had to swallow it. Who takes responsibility? God, no one. You're just hoping to breathe. And so, Scribbling the Cat, I don't know, Rianne, if you know this, but one of the most shocking things that happened, I wrote a book about a soldier who had been a veteran in the Rhodesian War, and they use it as a handbook for the suicide hotline in Johannesburg. They give it to the volunteers at the suicide hotline and they say, read this before you man the phones, because these are who are going to be phoning in. It's these soldiers for whom there is, you know, it's all of us who create soldiers, every single one of us who, you know, we as a nation are at war.
So let me switch to a moment just to leave a... We've spoken a bit about colonial responsibility in the context of both South Africa and Zimbabwe. Your book takes place in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, deals with a Tutsi cowherd turned rebel general, and deals with some of the questions of his role in the conflict and the question of child soldiers and their role. But take us back for a moment to the question of Belgium and France and their role in facilitating and enabling a conflict which today has caused the greatest number of war-related deaths
in the 20th century?
Well, you say only Belgium and France. I think we are in the United States. I think there is a role here as well. There will soon be a role for China in this whole game as well. You know, there was the book on Leopold II, Leopold II Ghosts, was written. He was a perpetrator in his way at the time. But when I was traveling in the Congo the last years, I very often felt I was in the same territory. There were these agents from all these foreign countries trying to rob the Congo. And in some ways, the most terrible thing is that there were these irresponsible people in power who helped them. So you always feel that the government, the people up there, they are parachuted onto their people, they are being helped by the people outside, and there is somehow no real opposition possible from underneath. And one of the things that I find very sad about a country like Congo that is in such a situation is that the intelligentsia and the people who have studied, somehow they all disappear in the world of the UN, NGOs, and they are, so often I meet people and I say, when they have studied, what's your ambition? Oh, I'm going to work for one of the pacification organizations. It's a business. And, you know, we are very critical today. At this moment, after having been in the Congo for many years, I'm on my way to Asia. We are very critical of what Asia is doing. But Asia is also jumping into a void which we ourselves created by not being occupied with economy, not local economy, only our own economy. We take and we get away with it. And these local governments get 10 or 15% and off you go. And somewhere underneath, there are all these people struggling. And when I look at somebody like Osani, the main character of my last book, he is a perpetrator. He is a man who has been drawn into a tunnel in which he had to do many terrible things. But on the other hand, it's the situation of void, no laws, no human rights, no economy that made it possible for him to become who he became. If you don't mind, I will read a very little piece about him, because I think the book in some way, because it's very fresh, it speaks better for him than I could do here. As we have the UN now in the Congo, I was in the lucky position that I would meet UN people, Africans, who would watch the African scene. And here is a man from Mali talking about my main character, and you will see how complicated it is. The main character is called Asani, and here is Colonel Mamadou looking at him. There were some people in this country, Colonel Mamadou thought, who needed to be protected against their own despair, and General Asani was one of them. Sometimes a man who was frightened stepped out into view, inevitably becoming a victim. Mamadou had been in Congo for the past 2 years as a military observer for the UN. He often went on missions into the interior, and he'd gotten to know the explosive mixture of conflicts in the East at close hands. Most people had selective memories. They did terrible things to each other and then screamed for help when the time for vengeance arrived. Each leader had his own agenda, and Congo always came second. He'd see no sign of a figure like Mandela or Malcolm X here. General Osani used to be an intelligence officer, or so he'd heard. That was a dirty job in the Great Lakes region, where human rights abuses had been the order of the day for many years. He must have seen and done horrible things. In this experience, people like Asani were damaged for life. You couldn't tell by looking, but it was as if parts of them had grown numb. Unable to trust anybody, they became afraid of their own shadows. Someone might know a certain thing about them, another person something else, but only they themselves knew the whole truth. Their secrets oppressed them and made them fearful. Mama then knew it hadn't been easy for Assani to come into Kinshasa when there was the peace agreements going on and he joined the National Army again. And when he saw him in front of his house one time, tall, lanky, the hollow eyes in his narrow face, restless and alert, he'd understood why. His Tutsi features made it impossible for him to merge into the crowd. The people of Kinshasa would always associate him with Rwanda, and probably not without reason. Once a man had worked for the security service, would the Rwandans ever completely let me go? So, that's his story.
So, someone like Assani may very well be standing trial before the International Criminal Court, a body that's been established to prosecute people for terrible crimes globally, and in this case is prosecuting a Congolese warlord for the crime of recruiting child soldiers. And it strikes me that the question of how you deal with this particular crime is very difficult and complex, and a lot of work that we've done globally. The attitudes of communities to child soldiers is sort of riven with contradiction. On the one hand, these children have committed some of the most barbarous acts you can imagine. On another level, they've been abducted from families at young ages and made to commit these acts precisely to remove them from the families.
Sometimes their mothers gave them because they thought they would come home at the end of the month with $100.
Precisely.
So there is again the economical void in which these things can happen.
So on the one hand, we rightfully condemn, prosecute, and try the people who are the masterminds, who recruit these children into ranks and deploy them in terrible civil wars. But the people who actually do the killing, we have a much more morally complex attitude towards them, and I think rightfully so. I'd love to hear your thoughts about child soldiers and what we do with them.
As you may have noticed in my book, I never used the term. And sometimes Assani would talk about my little ones. And I once said, you live like in an orphanage here. He was surrounded by 40 of these kids that were cooking for him and washing themselves under little showers. One day we were sitting together and he said, I'm going to give you something. And I don't know why I earned it, but he was going to give me something. And we were watching pictures, and he showed me some pictures of him on the front line with his child soldiers. And I was looking at them, and he gave one of them to me. And I said, these are just kids, you know? Because he was surrounded also by people who were a bit older. And he took the picture back. And he said, if you say that, you're not going to get this picture. I said, give it back to me. You said you were going to give me a gift. He said, no. This picture you may use one day, internationally. Because, you know, these people know nothing about writers. They thought I was a special spy sent by the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Louis Michel, called. Up to now, he's not even a minister anymore, but they always say Louis Michel is sending his people out. And so he thought I was going to go with this picture outside. I think it's very good that there is a world outside watching these things. Jean Atzfeld is not with us today, who has written extensively about Rwanda. And in his second book, The Machete Season, there is a Hutu killer who says, here we were. We went in the morning into the meadows to kill, and we brought back cows, and we were roasting the meat in the evening, and there were no witnesses. It's so important, I think, that there are witnesses on the ground and witnesses somewhere of which these perpetrators know about. On the other hand, there have been so many moments in Congo, for instance, when I was there in 97, when the Tutsi of the Rwandese new regime were chasing the Hutu in the interior of the Congo, and some of these Hutus were genocidal, but many of them, they just fled their families. There were kids born during these terrible marches they made in the interior of Congo. And once I made a trip with the UN in a very spooky boat that was very not worthy to be on that water. And we kept, we brought back the Hutu from the interior when they were coming with their rotten feet, and we were bringing them to town so as to bring them back to Rwanda. And when I was looking at these people, I sometimes thought, whatever they've done, you know, haven't they suffered enough to be punished? And I felt sometimes this way about Ahsani as well, you know. Here is a man, he is now a general in the National Army. He is living in Kinshasa in a nice villa. He has a wife, he has four kids. This man is chasing himself, you know. He's not at peace. He's being punished every day. So I think it is good. I live in Holland, when in The Hague, Thomas Lubanga, as one of the perpetrators, was brought to Holland, and they had to stick something to him, because really, I mean, everybody has had child soldiers. That's not really the worst of crime in Congo. That was stuck to him so as to have a pretext to judge him. It's good that it's there. On the other hand, I know quite some people who have been with Thomas Lubanga, and we should also watch out that these people who stay behind don't feel their leader has been taken and they are victims, because everybody will tell them you did wrong, even though the others did wrong as well. So we are in this situation so contradictory to whatever one would want it to be, that there are good guys and bad guys.
I was struck by two things that you said. One is the question of, when I listed the colonial responsibility for the Congo, you added in and the United States, and then you spoke about the question of witnessing. And I'm struck by the fact that the more we witness human rights abuse committed on the ground in these countries, the less we may see the real responsibility for where it may lie. And this brings me back to Francisco Goldman. When the Guatemalan Truth Commission made a finding that genocide had happened in Guatemala, they also said in a very telling and important piece that that genocide could not have happened but for the military and diplomatic and political assistance provided by the United States, that it could not have happened. And I think if you ask most people in the United States, in our time, has the United States been responsible for a genocide? Most people will think that that's a laughable and insulting question. So why is it, you've looked at Guatemala more closely than many have, but you also have a strong association here. Why is it that those bonds of connection and culpability are not drawn?
Well, you know, we have a wandering attention span. We have very short memories. The history of the United States is this is really, you have to go back in the story of even behind the Bishop Harardi case, you have to go all the way back to the 54 coup, right? This is where this whole story starts, where Guatemala has its one decade of democratic rule after colonialism and banana republic dictators, and they have one decade, and in its kind of anti-communist hysteria under the Eisenhower regime, it's that government, the Arbenz government, is overthrown. And everybody knows about that. They know that supposedly it was because United Fruit lands were being expropriated and the Dulles brothers were in Eisenhower's government. But that really overlooks what was really going on, right? Which was the United States beginning to formulate a policy towards Latin America, which was the same in the Middle East and Africa, of you know, waging kind of proxy wars against communism and supposedly the spread of communism. And so what they did in Guatemala, and the really important thing that happens in the 60s, when they begin to pour all this money and CIA training and so forth into the military intelligence units. They create this world of clandestine power. People who don't have to answer to the law, who don't even have to answer to whoever supposedly the president is at that moment, who work back then very closely with the CIA, and they do the dirty work. They do the famous death squads. They have the torture cells, right? And they become the heart of military power. And from there, the Guatemalan military becomes a new elite social class in Guatemala, right? As for the part of the United States, you know, the famous, I realized when I was researching the history of this a bit, the old Graham Greene paradigm about the innocent, you know, the quiet American, the American who means to do well and through his naivete and innocence actually does harm. I realized when you looked at Guatemala, that paradigm is wrong. And I think this expresses like a lot that we even see, think of Iraq and so many things, the way the United States actually operates in these countries. So it's the early 60s, and they're very, you know, Cuba's happened, and they're very worried about the influence of communism among young people and so forth. And pretty progressive people in the State Department and under Kennedy's Alliance for Progress, they say, you know, if we don't make reform possible, we are going to make the victory of the communists inevitable. And so they start this program in Guatemala to handpick bright, liberal young people from all walks of life to send them for scholarships in the United States, right? Where they studied how to become labor leaders and teachers and professors and so forth. And supposedly they're trying to help nurture, you know, this kind of liberal but pro-democratic young elite. Very idealistic, right? These guys come back to the United States, come back to Guatemala after they're being educated in the US, and they begin to sort of have an impact on society. What happens then in the world of military intelligence? Right? This is a country that is enforcing an extremely unjust society. You know, 2% of the population owns, you know, almost 90% of the land and the wealth and so forth. They don't like reform. So they begin to say reform is the door through which communism enters. Reformists always have communists behind them, they begin to say. And that's and so the military intelligence units, hand in hand with the CIA and the hardliners in the State Department, say, yes, these reformers have to be killed. So by the 1970s, 70% of those young people who'd been sent by the US up to the United States to study have now been murdered back in Guatemala by the other hand of the United States, which is the military intelligence units. Now what happens for not taking responsibility for this? Right? It's the military intelligence units who killed Bishop Harardi. They're the people, and people say, now those units, this peace commission, the truth commission, as you know, said that military intelligence has to be turned over to civilians. They ignored it, right? They've now become a power unto themselves. Yet people say, what's happened to them? There's no more guerrillas to fight. There's no more dirty war to wage. People say now that nobody's been murdered in Guatemala for political reasons in years, yet more people were murdered in Guatemala in 2006 than were murdered in Afghanistan. What's going on? These guys simply stayed there at the heart of Guatemalan power, clandestinely. The United States is Frankenstein monster. And they converted all those murderous skills to organized crime. So that now, the DEA says 70% of the cocaine that enters the United States is transshipped through Guatemala, and those military intelligence units that the US spawned basically have become FedEx for the cartels. You know?
So that's the theme of impunity for past atrocity, of political crime of the past metastasizing into organized crime in the present because nobody tackles the underlying political crime, may have some resonance in South Africa. The combination of disaffected young Nkontawesizwe combatants who only know violence as a way to earn a living and connected with a range of shadowy people connected to the old security forces. Is that too black and white a view of South Africa in the present?
It's very hard for me to talk about the internal structure of South Africa's criminal organized crime units. I speak therefore as a newspaper reader, and it is astonishing. I mean, say, if you take like one of the leading criminal operations in South Africa now, the South African Police Service, headed by Jackie Celebi, a man who's just been arrested, is about to stand trial for corruption. It's one of the few walks in South African life where there seem to be a degree of common purpose and racial integration was at the top of the criminal enterprise of which he was a member, which would have featured, yes, I mean, warrior types from either side who'd made their living by the gun and being clandestine. They just continued to use their same skills in the under the new dispensation for self-enrichment. Maybe they were always doing that. In fact, they probably were on both sides.
Before we begin to turn the floor to the audience, let me descend a little bit from the arena of the moderator into the arena to engage you on at least one of the points that you made about the South African Commission. I think that one of the most telling indicators that the South African Commission had been unbiased was the fact that in the 48 hours before its report was about to be issued, it was not the former nationalist government who sought to sue us to stop us issuing our report. It was the ANC. And in particular, Thabo Mbeki, the current president, was the leading figure in seeking to stop our report, at least in part because we argued in the report that notwithstanding the fact that the ANC had sought to fight and had generally fought a just war and had been a liberation movement seeking to remove a crime against humanity from our country, it had also in the course of it violated human rights and had violated the Geneva Conventions, and that in itself was unacceptable. So I'm hard pressed to concede the argument that the Commission was a biased pro-ANC entity if the ANC itself was seeking to stop us from being published. But here's the question. The Nazis and the French Resistance are not the same. And even if the French Resistance committed crimes, they're not morally equivalent. And so one of the great dilemmas, I think, with truth commissions and with the entire endeavor of trying to deal with the past is that you can't really be even-handed. That there is one side that rightfully demands condemnation, even if you decry and oppose and denigrate some of the tactics used by the people who are on the side of the angels. So I suppose that's the question.
I have no problem with the doctrine of collective guilt and complicity. It's like if you read my writings, I openly acknowledge it. I'd like some precision about what I stand accused of. In the South African context, I'm just going to have to play my cards as they are here and just speak the truth. It's going to be offensive to a lot of you. I feel that if you lose sight, if you can't distinguish between degrees of evil that you lost, I'm a member of the tribe that invented and perpetrated apartheid. I am one of them, okay? And in the times that, if you'd met me 20, 30 years ago when I lived in America briefly, I would have told you that I was a just white man, too noble to carry a gun for apartheid, etc., that some of my best friends were blacks and so forth. I was, of course, lying through my teeth. There came a time when I decided I was going to stop doing that, and the impression created by years and years of American television coverage of South Africa in the 1980s and the positions taken by the New York Times and the Washington Post gave this impression inter alia. Let's just talk about the numbers of political prisoners who died in the dungeons of the dreaded South African secret police. Some of them are in the audience here, I used to torment people by saying, well, how many people do you think have died in this way? The general impression given by Hollywood and the Western media was that people would say thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. I mean, you know, they thought they were talking a degree of evil that could be compared to Stalin's or Pol Pot's or Hitler's. The number is determined by your esteemed Truth Commission was 72 in the 40-odd years of apartheid, slightly more than two a year. And let me be the first to say,
that that's too many, and that as an Afrikaner, I'm ashamed of that. The torture was used by the secret police in a routine fashion. It's unforgivable, and so forth. But like I say, if I am guilty, I would like precision in the formulation of charges.
This we will return to, I'm certain, in the question time. But I wanted to speak to you a little bit more about Kay, and I think there's a link here. What struck me about Kay is that he was also an evangelical mm-hmm. Christian. And so the question...
Very handy.
Yeah, right. And so the question I wanted to put to you is, was his capacity for great brutality in spite of the fact that he was an evangelical Christian or because of it?
Oh, God was on his side, and his grandmother wore her knees out praying for him, which is why he had this incredible kill rate. He would go in, anyone who knows anything about the Rhodesian Light Infantry, they were the only all-white run group. I mean, there were the other sort of Rhodesian segments, recruits, they weren't sort of racist to that extent. They were so racist, the Rhodesian Light Infantry, that they had to recruit Belgians and Portuguese. And so Kay can speak, you know, he can say, fuck you, fuck me, and fuck my mother in Portuguese, French. I mean, it's, you know, the sort of soldiers' slang in all these languages, because they were so determinedly sort of white about it, and they were so determinedly right. And who is righter than God? And really, it's so hard if God is something a little bit slippery for you, or what if you don't believe in him? It is so hard to argue against someone whose belief in God is so literal. And so it is. I think God gets sucked into all sorts of debates. I think God's sort of floating around D.C. right now over a pale, large house. And I get panic-stricken when that happens, because I think recruiting absolute right, it's hard to argue against it. You sound a bit flippy-floppy and liberal.
And yet in Guatemala, the church played a remarkably important role in speaking truth to power.
Yeah, and interesting enough, in one family, you have this whole dichotomy expressed. The general who was most responsible for the genocide, who was dictator at the time, General Rios Montt, evangelical Christian, right? Killing in the name of God. The head of the Guatemalan Church Human Rights Office, after Herardi is murdered, is his brother, who's a Roman Catholic priest. You know, I mean, remarkable. And I remember asking him once, I mean, you know, how do you feel about your brother? He hated to talk about his brother. He wouldn't give interviews about it. But I mean, are you going to ever speak to your brother or anything? And he used to say, kind of a set phrase, but I remember how he answered. He said he believed in reconciliation as a consequence of justice. Basically, he was saying, yes, once he saw his brother tried and sent to prison, he'd be willing to go in and give him a big hug. You know?
Made for interesting Sunday afternoon lunches. So I think we're now at the moment where we're going to turn it over to you. Let's remember Paul's admonition to ask questions. And we have about 20 minutes to do so. So please.
There's a microphone there.
If you don't mind.
I've got a really big voice.
Can I
use it?
Oh, okay. So
I'd actually just like to get any or all of your reflections on your responsibilities as writers of these past atrocities. You are translating a truth for a much broader audience than those who might be immediately seeking reconciliation in a country. So I'd just like your reflections on that responsibility and how you might have thought about it or dealt with it. Thanks.
Why don't you kick off?
Yes, is my mic still on? Yeah, okay. Well, when I started doing the story of Asani, it's my third book on the Congo, and I felt in the first place that I wanted to give back to the Congolese a part of their history which they themselves don't know, and they really ignore, because they will say that Asani is Rwandese, while he is grown up in the eastern part of Congo in a village called Gagogo. And if I will say to common Congolese, the city Gagogo, they say, this is not a Congolese name, that must be in Rwanda. So they themselves situate this part of eastern Congo out of their own country because they don't know. And they are in the last years of Mobutu, because there are no more roads, because there are everything broke down, they are further away from each other than ever. And Asani comes from the eastern part of the country, which is 1,000 miles away from the capital. And he is about 10 miles away from the frontier. So it's a very modern problem, which we have in ex-Yugoslavia, which I recognize from many crises I knew as European, but which the Congolese, because they just, although they are living in the cities, somewhere their village is very alive in their heads. And living in a village meant in the old days that your enemy is on the other side of the river. So there is not this idea that somebody who has the features of a Tutsi, even though he has lived in the Congo since the end of the 19th century, he may be Congolese. So I thought, even though I think for many Congolese, because they are so much at this moment inside their wounds still, and they can't see yet in what way they themselves are responsible, I thought I had to dig into the history of this man and give it to them and show them how this man got into the tunnel, and maybe to make them think also that one day, if they are more quiet, that there's a little bit of responsibility that they have for his fate as well.
Rian, your book in South Africa and beyond stimulated a riot of conversation in, I think, an incredibly helpful and useful way. Do you see that as an intended outcome of writing the book? That's a responsibility of authors?
It's hard for me to say. I'm just a journalist and storyteller. Like, a lot of the conversation here is pitched at a level slightly above what I understand. I think that people like us should serve truth at all costs, and we should tell people who read us not just what they want to hear, but also things that are going to disturb them.
I think we should have listened to Dambadzo Marachera was a young writer in the 80s in Zimbabwe, and he came into this honeymoon period and he wrote a really violent book called The House of Hunger. Actually, he had been he'd been given a scholarship to Oxford, and he had tried to burn down his college because it just pissed him off that he got there and he was surrounded by a bunch of foppish Englishmen, and he didn't feel like that was any kind of education. And so he wrote this book while he was homeless and smoking pot with a bunch of Jamaicans, and he won the Guardian Booker Prize for it. So they had this big party, and he went to the party, and this Guardian editor stood up, and he was being all pompous about handing this prize. I think it was 1979 to Marachera, and going on and on about, you know, what a great young African he was. And Marachera just got so pissed off, he stood up and threw his coffee cup at the editor. And the editor sort of politely, the show must go on at all costs, he kept talking. So Marachera picked up his chair and threw that at the editor. And he self-destructed. If you read The House of Hunger, you can see the destruction within that. We were coming toward the end of the Rhodesian War, and in Marachera was all that passionate anger and frustration and impotence of a young, brilliant, oppressed black Zimbabwean. And he died, he couch surfed around a few friends' houses, and he died of HIV/AIDS. He is in one body, Zimbabwe. And we should have paid more attention to his howl. But you pick up that book. I recommend it to people all the time. I say, what book? They say, I'm going on safari to Zimbabwe. What book can I read that I can understand? I say, read this book. And I get these horrified emails back saying, I couldn't get past the point. It has violent, violent sort of sexual references. And these shocked people on their safaris, what they really want to read is Out of Africa. So they take that and forget, you know.
But, you know, I got into the Harari case
because I thought it was just the most sordid, cynical, unbelievable story I'd ever heard. When Bishop Hardy was first murdered in April of 98, I immediately assumed, oh, it's just the military, same old story, and so forth. And I didn't even pay that much attention to it, I have to admit. Then 3 months later, I was over in Spain, and El País, which is sort of the newspaper of record over there, it's like, you know, what's there must be true. It's like the New York Times. I opened the paper, and it announces that there's been this spectacular arrest in the Bishop Harardi case based on the findings of an eminent Spanish forensic anthropologist who has studied autopsy photographs of Bishop Harardi's skull and has found signs of dog bites. And that based on this, and it was photographs and 150 SWAT team commandos had descended on the parish house where he'd been murdered and arrested. There was a picture of a pudgy little priest in Gucci glasses and so forth being led away in handcuffs, and the dog was taken in as material evidence in the case, and they claimed it had been a homosexual crime of passion. And I really, as a storyteller, I hate to admit it, as a storyteller, I was delighted. I said, wow, a dog bites, whoever would have thought? You know, that's a great story. And it was a kind of cynical glee. And I remember I contacted, my friend suggested, I was with a friend in Spain who wrote for The New Yorker. He said, well, why don't you try and get a piece for The New Yorker? And so the only guy I knew at The New Yorker was Bill Buford, the fiction editor, who's a very cynical guy, so I knew he'd like it. And he did, and they gave me the assignment. And I got down there, of course. And within 24 hours of being down there, I realized it was not true, that it had been the same old, but at a level of ruthlessness and craziness and sophistication. It was all theater. It was all theater, and El País had sort of fell for it, and that was the beginning of an 8-year involvement in this legal case, this fight to resolve this one case. This is all about just one. People always say, you know, yes, we have us build democratic institutions, you know, we have a truth commission, that means there's going to be justice. And they don't realize how hard it is to make justice, just to put a tiny crack in that facade of impunity. An 8-year legal case with more than 10 people murdered, everybody in exile, and so forth. You know, that was the beginning of that.
I'd like to follow up with Mr. Goldman's comment about the sad plight of the U.S. educated young people who returned to Guatemala, and were 70% of which were sadly murdered. I'd like to ask each of you, if a cohort of gifted young people, poor young people, from each of the countries that you're talking about, South Africa, Rwanda, Congo, Zimbabwe, Rhodesia, were able to come to the United States and be educated in democratic ideals, and then returned home today, what would their plight likely be? Would they be welcomed? Would they have opportunities for leadership in their country? Or would they, sadly, be marginalized? Thank you.
I might just preface that by saying the United States of 2008, in my view, is probably not the laboratory that you want to send people to learn about democracy and human rights. If you refer to some instances, you know, well, okay. Rian.
I lived among you for many years, and I'm a great admirer of America. I think it is and the truest democracies ever created, and one of the brightest flowers on the human tree. I always used to defend you against your teeming enemies outside the country. I've stopped doing that since George Bush Jr. came to power, because he's just too much to cope with. But under apartheid, if you got hundreds of black kids here, they would have had great careers over the last 15 years. I think if you would do it today, it's like a lot of them would prefer to stay in America, because South Africa is high crime rates, and it's very uneasy, and it's, especially if you've got children, it's a bit dicey. There's a huge brain drain underway from South Africa, people with qualifications going in the wrong direction, irrespective of race.
Same thing with Congo. It's I recently met somebody in Belgium who said, I want to go back home. My family tells me not to come. They say they're so happy I'm here because I can help them. And They are very afraid that whatever talent I have will be wasted in my country. We have a lot of examples of Congolese coming, having studied in America or in Canada or in Belgium. They went back after the Mobutu era. They were very close to Kabila. They were called the diaspora, and everybody thought they were going to change everything. They went into business. They went into the worst things. I remember one time a man who'd studied in Boston. I was somewhere in a village in the south of Congo, the native province of Kabila, and there was a local king being installed. And there he was, this man from Boston. And he was a minister at the time, and he was sitting on stage, and there were girls dancing and singing in the chorale. And later on, one of the princes of the court came to me and he said, I'm so embarrassed because this man has come and he wants one of these girls, you know, and he wants to take her into bed. But these are girls from the village and they're maybe not clean and I will have to get dresses for them. And why did he only tell me at the last moment? And so off he went to go and find for this Boston educated man a girl from the village. So I think it's not a guarantee. I often felt that... This is just a very thin layer. There are so, as I said earlier, the village is still inside the man as well. And one generation of education and 4 years or 5 years in America cannot take that away.
I might intervene and let someone else come to the mic just in the interest of...
Thanks very much. Archbishop Tutu has often said, if someone takes my pencil, he can say, I'm sorry I took your pencil. He can say, I never will take your pencil again. But ultimately, the question is, would you please give me back my pencil? My question is, do you think, and whoever wants to answer this, that interpersonal or political reconciliation is possible without the economics of reconciliation?
This is a good question for somebody from Zimbabwe.
I think Zimbabwe's proof that, you know, I'll never forget, okay, Zambia is actually a really good example of how that worked. After the war, my mother was so heartbroken that we had lost the war, she had lost the war in Zimbabwe, that we had to go to Zambia. But she could handle living in Zambia, which had been independent since 1964, and she didn't feel like she had lost it. So there were about 1,000 white people living in the whole of Zambia at that time, and so there was none of that racial tension. When KK came to power, there was... socialism, it meant everyone was poor. The only people who were driving around on Mercedes-Benz were government officials or American, people who imported their own toilet paper. But everybody else, there was a level of collective poverty. And I remember Zimbabwean farmers, friends of mine, coming up to a wedding in Zambia and saying, my God, how do you live like this? You live like blacks. And I said, I know, peaceful, isn't it? And now those same Zimbabwean farmers are having to come north, and there's these mass emails I get, which I find very amusing, saying, we find it a little bit cosmopolitan at the club. They refuse, all this garbage about, no, the peace is lovely and we're all integrated in Zimbabwe was rubbish. It was rubbish, it was economic rubbish. For real reconciliation, you can't be sitting there aching for what someone else has that you don't have. And I have to say, the other people who were really rich in Zambia back in the 80s were the mandrax dealers. Mandrax is the drug of choice in Zambia. I think it's like speed or something, or maybe it's a down, I don't know, I never took it. We've always drunk. But the thing about the mandrax dealers, they were always racing around in Mercedes as well, but they were Zambian. And it wasn't the poke in the eye of seeing a whole bunch of white farmers racing around in their Mercedes Benzes. And I think that poke in the eye was what enabled Mugabe to do what he did. He didn't do that alone. Mugabe didn't say, I'm going to be a disaster and then be single-handed. He said, let's be a disaster. And so we were.
So we can take one question if it's 30 seconds and a 30-second answer.
The question I had is also from the woman from Rhodesia, Zimbabwe. Okay,
wherever.
Yes.
Wyoming, actually, yeah.
But you know, when I hear the story of Zimbabwe, I hear a lot about the failure of Britain to live up to the agreement to pay for the big farms and so that it could get compensation. And then I hear a lot about the IMF going after Zimbabwe I'm just wondering what you have to say about that.
Well, it got corrupted. There was a perversion, and the Brits said, well, we're not going to be part of this process if there's corruption involved. And so it all stalled out because it rotted. It rotted. It went, you know, you can have a grand idea, but if the people implementing the grand idea are so corrupt that the idea rots in their hands, then you're left holding nothing but a mess.
So I think we have come to the end of our time. And
just about. I'm going to take a minute or two of this time with three moments. First of all, a quotation, then a pen statement, and then to remind you, why don't I do it immediately, that books will be on sale afterwards. 192 Books has the books of our distinguished panel. The quotation comes to me from something I heard Rian say. Right after this session, I will be moderating a conversation on books that changed my life, insofar that we believe that books can change a life. I'm going to be using this on the panelists in about half an hour, and I think it's appropriate to read it now out to you. If the book we are reading does not wake us, as with a fist hammering on our skull, why then do we read it? So that it shall make us happy? Good God, we would also be happy if we had no books, and such books as make us happy, we could, if need be, write ourselves. But what we must have are those books which come upon us like ill fortune and distress us deeply, like the death of one we love better than ourselves, like suicide. A book must be an ice axe to break the sea frozen inside of us, not quite outside Africa, but from Franz Kafka. Finally, the statement from Penn. You will notice an empty chair on the stage. This chair represents those artists around the world who have been robbed of their right to freedom of expression, who are prevented from practicing their craft openly or without fear of persecution, and who are unable to join us today. It is a reminder that the silencing of writers in one country robs the entire world of their voices. This particular chair is dedicated to one of our colleagues currently in prison in China. This year, PEN America Center is conducting an international campaign to win the release of more than three dozen writers and journalists in Chinese prisons before the Olympic Games, roughly in 100 days from now. At this event, we remember Kong Youping, internet writer and factory worker, arrested on December 13, 2003, after posting 5 articles and 7 poems on an overseas website that alleged corruption. Kong was sentenced on September 16, 2004, to 15 years in prison for subverting state power, a sentence that was reduced to 10 years on appeal. He is currently being held at Lingyuan City Prison, and is reportedly suffering from high blood pressure and deteriorating eyesight. Please join PEN efforts to win the release of Kong Youping and of all writers and journalists currently in prison in China. Sign the petition at the PEN table outside of many festival events and join PEN as a member to support all of our programs. You can also sign the petition and join PEN online at www.pen.org. And now, without further ado, thank you very much.